The WLEW News and Public Affairs Department now presents What Do You Think? Here's your host, Craig Routson, with today's topic.
Good morning. Our guest today in the studio, Carl Osentoski, Executive Director of the Huron County EDC, Economic Development Corporation. We're going to be talking about the work of the EDC, things they've got going on, some things in the area that they're trying to bring in and make things better. Thanks for being with us, Carl.
Thanks for the invitation.
EDC, basically, that's been around quite a while in Huron County.
It dates back to the mid-1980s.
Oh.
Now, I haven't been there quite that long. Pre-smartphone. Pre-cellular phone.
Almost pre-rotary phone.
Almost. It's been a while.
And through the years, you and your predecessors have been working to bring business and economic development to the area that keeps things going.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And our philosophy with economic development is, in a lot of situations in other communities or other regions of the state, they operate at a county level, and they go into communities and try to tell communities what they should be doing. Our process, we've learned by observation that doesn't always work as well as it could. So we've kind of reversed the whole process. What we try to do is we'll go in and work with the community when we're invited. Our role is to bring resources, contacts, information, knowledge to the local community, and we listen to them, understand what their interests are, whether it's downtown development or industrial retention, attraction kinds of pieces, any of those kinds of things that a community is interested in, could be housing. And then we go back, kind of work through that, understand what resources might be available at the regional, state, or federal level, and then try to line those resources up and try to engage the community as best we can with those resources.
You're also like a sounding board where, you know, if they're looking to do this, you can tell them, okay, you want to get this kind of industry to come into your little park,
right,
but you don't have sewer, and this type of industry really needs that. You either have to think about developing that or maybe focus somewhere else, because, you know, we have like the people from Meyer who are looking at north of town.
Right.
They want city water and sewer.
Right.
That's a necessity to come in for them, the way they develop. Other businesses do the same thing. If they're coming into your community, they need to know the infrastructure's there before you even start.
Absolutely. We get a lot of interest in food processing. And one of the requirements for food processing is, depends on the industry, but kind of as a general sense, they use a lot of water and a massive amount of wastewater, sewer system. Cass City had to expand their system
for
the milk plant, for the DFA plant over there. So it's kind of a balancing act for us. I mean, we try to encourage communities to look at attracting and developing businesses, but we want to make sure that it fits within the context of the community so that they don't get in over their head on infrastructure, sewer, water, roads, those kind of things.
And even if you have the water system in there, they may want more city type water than well water from a tower.
Exactly.
It's a little more rustier, it's more corrosive. They may have to pre-treat it. That adds to expenses,
yep,
and they're going to want to know what they're coming into.
Absolutely. So what we try to do is, when we're working with the communities, and kind of in a general sense, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. We have a general understanding of what the communities have to offer. And to be honest, I mean, we're working with small rural communities. We were in discussions and currently are in discussions to bring in a national speaker to work on filling empty retail spaces in downtowns. And we're doing this on a 7-county regional basis. But when in the discussions, we were talking about the size of our communities. And we said, you know, Bad Axe is roughly around 3,000 people, plus or minus. And she goes, that's tiny.
And you're telling me, this is the county seat.
This is the county seat. Exactly. I said, you know, some of our communities are as small as, you know, 250. And she was just amazed at the size of the communities. And we said, That's why we work out here, is because we enjoy the size of the communities, we enjoy the communities and the people that work and live there.
And but the downtowns thrived years ago because people didn't travel as far. The roads weren't as reliable, the vehicles weren't as reliable, so you shopped kind of more locally in your small town unless you needed something you couldn't get there. And that's why the downtowns and the smaller places began, and now we're trying to find a way to revive them with some kind of a niche.
Exactly. That darn internet wasn't invented either, so you know.
Don't say that darn internet, because I know you worked hard to get broadband.
We did, and still continue to work on fiber optic networks and marketing that. I only say that in jest.
Okay.
But retail has changed dramatically. I mean, even in cities, it's harder and harder for general purpose retailers, JCPenney's, Target's, Walmart's. I mean, Walmart just closed a bunch of stores because they weren't competitive. So even a company as big as Walmart is still kind of trying to understand the whole retail environment. And in smaller communities, in rural areas, it's even harder because it was built many, many years ago when the demographics and shopping patterns were very different. And now, people don't think about jumping in a car and driving to Bay City, Saginaw, Port Huron to go shopping. Where when I was growing up, it was dramatically different. That was a day-long event, and I remember packing a lunch. So it was very, very different.
Well, and nowadays, we have just so much more out there. It used to be, you know, when you were in town here, when I first came up here, you know, you could go to the local store and you could find a belt for your vacuum.
Right.
There are so many different belts for so many different vacuums, they can't stock them all. So you end up going to the internet to get one, or they have to special order it for you, because unless they're actually selling that brand and that model, they may not have it right in stock.
Absolutely, absolutely.
There's only so much you can put out on the shelf
right. In
a small business.
Oh, sure. And the varieties are changing. But we're working to address some of that, because we're working on the idea that you could actually 3D print that part on your desktop, a 3D printer, and you wouldn't even have to do that. You would go to Hoover's website, the wheel is broken, you just print it out. The power of the internet.
That would be terrific. But, you know, as soon as that happens, they're going to make home printers that'll do it, and then you're going to bypass the store anyway, and the whole point is to get business going.
Exactly. And what we're focused on is how do we anchor it to a place? Mm-hmm. That's the challenge, because if I'm making something, I'm making Hoover vacuum cleaner wheels.
We talked about Hoovers. And years ago, I went to Detroit, and there was a Hoover store with a big parts selection. You could get anything you wanted, but it was down in the city where they could make a go of it. But up here, you know, you wouldn't be able to pay the light bill, let alone, you know, make a living off of it for all the parts we would have to possibly sell in the area.
Exactly. And that's, you know, that's part of the power of the internet, is you can go to Amazon, you can get replacement parts, you go directly to Hoover or to their parts department, and you can order all of that stuff online.
But what you don't get is the personal service or somebody who knows how to put it on.
Correct. And again, the challenge is how do we anchor that in a community? How do we encourage local businesses to start up and stay in local communities? If I can manufacture something in my garage, why would I move to a store downtown? So that's kind of the challenge that we're working through right now, and that's why we're looking at outside expertise.
Probably because your neighbors don't want all that traffic.
Well, it could be. I mean, part of it is zoning, and part of it, you know, truck traffic or UPS or FedEx or those kind of things. But
specialty shops seem to be what you need downtown. The big box stores around in all the communities nowadays take a hit on all the town shops we had before. So it seems like you need to find almost something that's a niche that, you know, no one else has.
Well, and that's part of why we're working through this process. On a regional basis, we're working in a 7-county region. We just completed a mapping program or a mapping effort to identify craft agriculture, whatever that is. I mean, and the definition is kind of flexible, but we're looking at farms, microbreweries, wineries, and what we're hoping to do is to kind of understand how they're organized, where they are, and if there's an opportunity to maybe bring either some new microbreweries or small-scale food processors. So if I'm making jams or jellies, I can scale up. I might use our kitchen incubator over at our tech center.
Which you are looking for people who can utilize it.
Absolutely. So if anybody's out there looking for a commercial kitchen to test recipes or to kind of do some entry-level marketing, we can do that.
And the benefit of that is you see how it is in production. You can do it in your kitchen, but when you got to make it on a more large scale, sometimes it's a little different, and you've got to meet standards for the USDA and all of these things that go into before you can put it in a store.
Exactly. Michigan has a craft food law available online. And if I were making my jams and jellies and just selling it at a farmer's market, it's all good. It has to be labeled as cottage food, but if I decide that I want to sell it in a retail establishment or kind of scale up and get bigger, I need a commercial kitchen.
If you want to be on the aisle at McDonald's Food and Family Center that has the local products, you would need to meet certain standards.
Exactly, and that's where the commercial kitchen would come in. It would allow me to scale up the product, and I can test the market out of my kitchen at a farmer's market someplace in the county. But if I want to go into retail, if I want to sell online or those kind of things, I have to be able to operate in a commercial kitchen. That's what the tech center is for, is to kind of scale up. But once you reach a certain point, you need to take that next step and have your own commercial kitchen. And we've had several folks do that out of the kitchen incubator.
But that also tells you the type of equipment you need.
Exactly.
You don't need to get the normal food processor you get there. Maybe you need something more industrial that's going to hold up in the long term. You can see what they look like and how well they work and how it helps the process.
Exactly. And the beauty of that is if we can attract those kinds of businesses, first of all, they're rooted in place. They're from the local community. And the processing can actually take place. If I'm making my jam, I can process it in maybe the back of a retail store in downtown, but in the front, I can be selling retail, and it's something that's different, unique, and not every community has it. So it kind of plays
on
both.
Kind of like
a bakery. Kind of like a bakery.
In the back, and they sell it up front.
Exactly, and it brings people in. It's kind of a tourism draw, but it also hopefully will employ a couple people. And so we're looking at that as kind of the model. Microbreweries are a shining example of how you do that. Is the production is typically in the back, the tap room is in the front, and a lot of times they use local ingredients. They'll try to source it as close to the production facility as possible. We've had some discussions with the folks down at Thumb Coast Brewery in Port Huron, and they've been reaching out to some of the hop farmers in the Thumb region to try to get some of those hops into some of their production, harvest ales and those kind of things. So it's we always hold up microbreweries, not just because I like beer, but because
it makes you a jolly good fellow. It does.
But it also, it's anchored in place because people want to know where the components of that jam, jelly, and beer come from. I mean, and if you can say, I bought the hops, 4 miles down, I know the grower, he's been providing us for the last 2 years. I mean, it kind of creates that story of place, and that's what we're looking to do.
And it also can help make the product unique in flavor and everything else. I'm a firm believer in Michigan apples. I can tell a Washington apple every time I eat it because I was raised in the northern suburbs of Detroit, and we always went up and we got bushels of apples, and I know what Michigan apples taste like. They're grown in a different soil, different climate, and I can tell.
Exactly, and that's what makes beer production or wine production locally very different, and because it's all rooted in place. I mean, you can go to Founders in Grand Rapids, and they're buying hops from the West Coast or Germany, and it kind of lacks that. Even though they're a local brewery, they're a big brewery, and we're looking at, can we establish microbreweries in our local communities that can support themselves? They may sell to a tourism audience, but is there a way that we can encourage that kind of growth, organic growth locally? And we're looking to do that with beer, wine, distilled spirits. Michigan State University, we've discovered, has a distillers program. I'm going to do a little more research here.
But sounds like you're getting your retirement plans.
I'm kind of lining up here. But the idea is that maybe we can engage some of those folks. Central Michigan University has a brewers program. And what we want to do is to go over and talk to those folks and say, are you looking for when you're getting ready to scale up to a microbrewery kind of thing? What do you need? How big a building? Because we have buildings in our downtowns.
And we have local establishments that might like to be able to feature a local beer.
Absolutely, absolutely. And a lot of times what microbreweries do is they'll focus on a great case in point is Elk Street in Sandusky. They started off doing just microbrewery in a tap room. They didn't have food, and what they would encourage people to do is to go to the local restaurants, grab a pizza, get takeout, bring it over, and have it with some of their locally brewed beer, which supports both the restaurants and the microbrewery. So there's ways to design these things so that there's some synergy for it. In other places in the state, I think in Traverse City, a microbrewery will deliberately not serve food, but encourage some of the food trucks up in Traverse City to park outside.
Well, and they have a lot of wineries up that area, Lake Michigan there, they get a lot of grapes growing. But we have them growing locally here, too. And we have wineries in the area, not a lot, but we have some that are seem to be continuing doing their products.
Interestingly enough, if you go back, there was Seaboing Beer was brewed locally. There was a small but pretty vigorous wine growers area over in Seaboing.
Really?
One of the former county commissioners brought in some plat books dating back to 1900, and there were advertisements for wineries. So there's a history.
But in the 1900s, there wasn't a lot of mass trucking that we have today.
Oh, correct.
So what you brewed locally was consumed locally because that's what people had to deal with. And then again, we've gone through the whole model change of businesses downtown and the big stores and all the rest of this.
Right.
That have come full circle back on us.
It comes full circle. So that's why people want to know where their food is coming from. They want to know where what they're drinking, where it's coming from. And if we can establish some of these, it's a nice model for filling up some of those downtown stores and kind of starting that process. We don't have all the answers, but we're looking at that as a potential model for us.
And there's a difference between home brewing and brewing for the public, so they have to know about the proper equipment, the proper testing, the proper you gotta pasteurize it or whatever you do to make sure it's safe to drink. You know, when you do it at home, what comes out. And you and your friends, if it gives you Montezuma's revenge, well, so
I've tasted some really interesting things coming out of a 5-gallon bucket. But the idea, though,
that leads to
we want that's an image I'm going to try to scrub out of there. But the idea. You bring up home brewers. We think that that's an interesting audience for us because there's a small group of home brewers out in the county. And one of the things that we've talked about with some of the communities is sponsoring or hosting a home brewers festival where they can go out and there are certain state regulations. You just can't, you know, bring your beer in and, you know, start giving it away.
Hey, it's alcoholic beverages. It's regulated.
Exactly. So we want to make sure that we're not ignoring that. We want to make sure that we work within the state guidelines. But there are opportunities to have home brewers clubs do tastings. And we thought that might be kind of an interesting way to start some of the discussions with the local community. It's easier to do. These folks are already practicing brewing, and it'd be fun. It would be a fun event. So we're just trying to understand who's out there, where they're brewing, and if they might be interested. If there's a home brewers club, we're going to try to find that out. And one of the things that we've thought about doing is going to some of the local stores that provide the components for home brewers. Ideal Party Store over in Bay City. There's a couple places over in Bay City, Saginaw, Port Huron that have the kind of raw ingredients for home brewers. And just talking with them about some of their customers.
But your office also helps on the other end of the process here. How do you start a business? Business plans, all these types of things that you're going to need before you decide you're going to rent the building space downtown. Yes. And start a brewery and buy some equipment. You've got to know that you have a plan in place. The banks will support you. That everything you can, the licensing, how to go about all of this stuff. You're the ones who can help steer them in the right direction that way. Either with programs that are out there, starting a business, I see them come through every so often, or other things that you can help them with.
Absolutely. You make it sound really complicated, Craig.
Well, the beer part is probably the fun part, but like any business, there's the paperwork, there's the paper
right.
trail, there's making sure supplies come on time. rents paid, all this kind of stuff that, you know, people don't think of when they walk in.
Strange things like logistics and actually, we have some great small business counselors. We participate in a program called the Michigan Small Business Development Center program. There's been some changes with that. They've regionalized.
Michigan Works, you had a great program where they were almost like genie or like those things on TV, the people who help you out when you're starting a business, you know, will help support you financially or whatever.
Yep.
They had a kind of a program like that, but a lot of things have changed.
Right.
Because they've gone to a different region and different priorities come in. They now include Flint, so I'm sure water quality is better
now. Yeah. But the Small Business Center program operates throughout the seven-county region that we mm-hmm. work in. It's headquartered at Kettering University in Flint. But we have the interesting thing is that one of our counselors that serves the region has a specialty in restaurants and food. So he understands the industry. He's been able to help. We've been referring folks over to him for the last 6 months. And he's been doing a really, really nice job helping develop the business plans, kind of guiding them through the regulatory process, making sure that they've thought through this, and basically getting them prepared to go to a local lender to get that business loan.
You have to know how to set up the back room to do the brewing. Before you even put the equipment in, you want to make sure you have walls that are easy to clean so you can pass all these inspections.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of them look old and nice, you know, antique-y, but you may need to do a little upgrading in order to just keep the hygiene.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're talking about anything with food, it's got to be food grade. It's got the finishing materials on the inside have to be a certain quality. Michigan Department of Ag has to be involved at a certain level, depending on what the food product is. So there's lots of those kinds of intermediate steps that you have to go through.
Storage and how cool it has to be. All these types of things come into play that you're not necessarily thinking about when you think, I want to do a home brew.
Exactly. And, you know, we would encourage people not to just to go out and buy a storefront, because once you change use, if it's a clothing retail store that was closed for a while, but if I want to do my jams and jellies, that's a change in use. So there's a lot of other pieces that have to be looked at. Building and zoning has to be engaged. I mean, so there's lots of...
You might need the electrical to be upgraded because all you had were lights and heat before, and now you've got heavy equipment that's you got to cool and cook and everything else.
Ventilation and those type of things.
And
absolutely.
Neighbors upstairs and may not necessarily be happy with the ventilation if it isn't right.
And neighbors upstairs. So it's all of those pieces. So we try to encourage people to think this through. We've got some resources. And again, it's part of our job is to connect those businesses or those potential businesses with the resources in the region and in the state, and ultimately, if possible, the federal government. So
and
we try to balance
that. I'm kind of kidding around here about this, you know, stuff, but I mean, it shouldn't daunt people that it's impossible to do all this extra work. Everyone who started a business has done this.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it's a process, and as long as you have someone who can help guide you through it, it isn't an undaunting one.
And the state has dedicated resources to encourage people. I mean, we don't see them as an obstacle. They're a regulatory agency. We understand that. We have to make sure that we meet whatever the standards are. But the idea is that they're there for a reason. I mean, the food cottage food law is there for a reason, to protect the public's health. I mean, so we want to make sure that we meet all of those things, but we try to encourage people that it's not insurmountable, that, you know, even though sometimes it feels like it's complicated and you never get through it, there are resources and people out there that can help. And that's our job, is to connect those resources. We're not the experts on everything, even though I tell my kids that.
Well, that's a
famous thing. Yeah, this is different. But the idea is that we can connect them to resources. I'm not the expert, but my job is to connect the dots.
Again, the incubator is available. If they want to try it out, then contact your office to find out what times are available and if it's a product that I believe you have it at the tech center out there.
Yep.
If the equipment out there is set for this type of project you're doing.
Absolutely. They can contact our office. We can put them in contact with the tech center if they want to tour the kitchen. We've had a lot of businesses go through and look at the kitchen so that they can understand what kind of equipment is out there, the size, scale of the equipment, some of the rules and regulations that the tech center has.
And with school letting out, it's available a little more often than it is during the regular school year when the kids are there during the day.
Right, and that's part of our partnership with the tech center is when the kids are in class, we're not allowed to use the incubator kitchen unless it's in the packaging room. There's a separate room just for packaging. But typically after the kids from, we say roughly 8 until 3, the kids are going to be in the classroom. But after that, nights, weekends, and during the summer, it's generally available. We have an online, once you go through all the paperwork, yes, we do have paperwork that we require.
Because you have to know who's in that building.
We have to know.
The school has responsibilities for all that equipment in there, and what's in there is supposed to stay in there, that type of thing.
And the most important thing is that we're using their commercial kitchen license to be able to do this. So part of the requirements just is an application for our office so we can understand what kind of food product that they're going to be producing. We require, as does the tech center, that they complete something called ServSafe. And that's a food handling protocol that the state of Michigan uses. Restaurants, food handlers have to do that. And it's just, a lot of it is just very basic common sense that you keep certain foods cool. You don't want to put mayonnaise in the sun, those kinds of things.
Don't cross-contaminate.
Exactly.
Like that.
You want to make sure.
Meat, and then you got to make sure you're properly cleaned before you go work on the sauce.
Exactly. So it's those kind of common sense things. But there's a program out there. MSU Extension does the training on it periodically. So what we do is we encourage people, and not just in Huron County, it's Extension statewide. So if they miss the most recent training up in Bad Axe, we can send them to Caro or to Sandusky. So we can do that. We ask that they have liability insurance, and after that, they go through all the process, work with Michigan Department of Ag to make sure that they get a permit to produce the food. Once they go through all of that, they get a key card that allows them to get into the building 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we talk about how they can get into the building because there's security systems in place. But then they can use it virtually whenever it's not in use, being used for the school.
And again, we make it sound so complicated, but people are doing it. People have gone through this.
Absolutely.
You know, citizens around the county who just had
Absolutely.
An idea and they've just gone through the process
right.
and are trying to create a business for themselves.
Absolutely. So it's not as daunting as it might seem. You know, we've had people take the ServSafe test just by reading the book, thinking about it, and taking the test, and they passed. So it's not terribly complicated. It's just a series of steps, and our job is to work them through those steps so that they can get qualified and into the kitchen testing their food product. The resources at the tech center are phenomenal. I mean, a full-scale commercial kitchen with some small-scale packaging at the back end of it for the food products. They've been great partners with us. So.
I know you wanted to talk about other regional things. We've kind of gotten off track here.
That's okay.
We've eaten up
That's
some
okay.
time, but you do a lot of work regionally. The state kind of likes that. They think they're getting more bang for their buck if they're going regional rather than just
right.
we'll do one here in this little town and one here in this little
right.
town. You got a region that's doing something. They think, they're doing more for
right.
everybody.
Right, and it's a way that the state can manage resources. When we started this program, probably about 4 years ago. We were part of the Saginaw Bay region, and it was a big region. It was, I think, 13 counties that was in that region. About 4 years ago, the state went through and said, that region's too big. It doesn't seem to function well. And so they realigned us into the I-69 trade corridor region and renamed us the I-69 thumb region. We're region 6. And there's actually the interesting part. Is that there's two levels to this. At one level, we work with our fellow EDC members, which sounds weird because you would think that we would be in competition. And we kind of are.
Well, you want the things to come to your county that you're
right,
you're
absolutely.
For, but you know in the region if it happens, good things can happen elsewhere.
Exactly. I mean, I know that if a company expands in Sandusky, people from Huron County will find employment down there. And if something happens up in Bad Axe, people from Cass City will drive over or from other places in the Thumb region. It gets a little more complicated as we move south. But again, you know, if the region is strong, if there's a strong industrial base in Imlay City, some of our manufacturers might be supplying them because they're in close proximity. And even some of our employees might be residents might be driving down to Imlay City. Depends on.
I've lived here long enough to know people who drive down to Detroit to work.
Exactly. So, you know, if it's a strong region, and it allows the state to kind of, at one point, they were showing a map, the state, the governor's office, had 83 different layers of state government. Department of Transportation had different regions. Michigan Department of Agriculture had different regions than MDOT. Michigan Economic Development had totally different regions. Department of Aging had different regions. So what the governor said, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me. We're going to start realigning all of these regions. And there are 10 regions in the state. We're in region 6. So part of our job is to work with the other economic developers in the region to look at what we can do cooperatively to attract and retain businesses. And we're working through part of that. In fact, I was on a conference call this morning. There's a group that's going to be going to on a recruiting mission to Ontario, Canada, early this spring. And they're going to be going over and meeting with companies that might be interested in relocating into Michigan and ultimately into this 7-county region. We could never have even participated in that. I'm not able to go, but the other EDC directors will bring back the contact information, and if it matches up to one of our local communities, and it kind of goes back to some of the earlier discussions about water and infrastructure, talent base, all of those pieces, if it matches up, then we get a shot at working with that company. But
you also have the advantage of the shoreline. You have an area to attract people to for the recreation after work.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the fun balance for me, is that we have 90 miles of shoreline in Huron County. I mean, Genesee doesn't have that.
They have the Flint River, which
we won't go into that.
You can walk across even in the summertime.
you can do some really interesting things with the Detroit or Flint River. But we do have. And that's where we think... We can be really, really competitive. One of the first things that we did with, there's another effort called the Regional Prosperity Initiative, directly through the governor's office. And one of the first things we did, we operate in the same 7-county region, was to map fiber optic networks, since you brought it up. And surprisingly, the entire Thumb region and the 7 counties is incredibly wired with fiber optic.
I think AVCI had a deal to do with that. They're a local company, and they pushed to get it through.
Absolutely. It's the local companies that we actually got the information from. The village of Seaboing is one of the first gigabyte communities in the state of Michigan.
That because, you know, you can get a line there that's faster than your machine can take.
Exactly. They have fiber optic capabilities similar to Google Fiber. That people were competing with and still compete with around the country. So, and interestingly enough, Owosso, because of a local company, a local cable provider, wired the community with fiber optics. So we've got two communities that have incredible infrastructure. How do we leverage that telecommunications capabilities with downtown development or shoreline development? So if I'm a person who does programming, would I want to live in downtown Detroit? Maybe. Or would I want to work on the water someplace where I can put my feet up, watch deer in the afternoon, go out and fish, or go swimming, or biking, or whatever it might be. So
things like a server center, things like that, if you've got that kind of speed in and out, you know, you can do some things that other communities can't.
Exactly. And we've already started some discussions around those kinds of server farms or data warehouses or those kind of things. So we're trying to take that information that we developed at the regional level and leveraging it back into the local communities. How do we use our lifestyle, which is very different on the shoreline, and attract, and we don't need 1,000 people to come into a community. A difference could be made with 10 families coming into a community, a Seaboing or a Caseville or a Bad Axe. If we can attract 10 families in, we've changed the dynamics in the local community.
And these types of jobs you're talking about are living wage jobs.
They're absolutely.
Not, they're not where you're going to have a second and third job to raise your family type of thing. These are, well, with the internet thing, the tech jobs, those usually pay pretty good.
Exactly.
And you'll have that into your economy.
Exactly. So that's where, and again, it's one of those things where there's been a sea change with technologies, just like with the retail environment in Amazon and all of the online vendors. It's the same kind of thing, where before you might have to be physically in an office park in Southfield. Now you can telecommute, you can Skype in, you can FaceTime, you can use all of the telecommunications technologies, but you could be living on in the shoreline community. So there's some really interesting things that we're trying to explore. There's been some interesting reports coming out and research coming out on something called the gig economy, which instead of me having a full-time job working for a particular business, essentially I'm a freelancer. And my job is to do whatever that freelance business I'm engaged in is. And I work from job to job to job. We're perfectly set up for that because we're close to Metro Detroit if you need to get in and out, or if you have clients down in the Detroit metro area or Lansing or Flint.
You can get to Tri-City Airport if you need to fly out somewhere.
Exactly.
Usually the company that's hiring is paying the bill anyway.
And if I'm careful about where I buy a house, I can walk out to the beach.
Yeah.
So it's a very different dynamic, and we're trying to figure out as economic developers how we can integrate our communities. Again, it comes back to that place-based economy. How do we anchor those people, those businesses, even if it's a freelance business, how do we anchor that in a local community?
Well, and this goes back to your efforts to get that broadband up here, because for a long time, businesses needed a faster connection.
Right.
That they couldn't sit there and wait for that irping sound of your modem to go through.
I kind of missed that.
Dial-up, and because they were doing computer-aided design and they needed to send this to some place where they could make the part and get it then shipped to them. All of these types of things were not available until we got the high speed around.
A lot of our manufacturers had to go online and wait to download blueprints.
They were doing it at the tech center for a while.
Exactly.
Because they had a high-speed connection.
They had a high-speed connection. Exactly. So as technology's improved and we've encouraged companies to look at the thumb area as a potential, you know, we've started to look at things like, and I know AVCI has started to expand their horizons into fiber to the farm, because as technology on the farms have changed, I mean, people are always amazed when you say, well, our agricultural community has to download software patches for their tractor. And they said, what? You know, they don't understand that agriculture is very high tech.
Geo-tracking in the tractor, it practically drives itself to plow the field precisely.
Exactly, and we're starting to look at and understand the use of drones on farms. Even though the Federal Aviation Administration is still working on regulations, we see that as a huge potential growth industry. But as those drones capture information on farm fields, how do you get it to people who can use it? Not just the local farmer, but maybe seed dealers,
fertilizer companies. All these things are showing that this part of your field could use a little more. This part has already got plenty of, don't spray there, put it here.
Exactly.
All of these things that make it more efficient, more cost effective for the farmer, and better bottom line.
Right. So that's where we're looking at, you know, how do we more fully engage fiber to the farm? How do we work with some of our ag community to layer that technology into their farms?
And that's going to be difficult, because I know even cable, you know, you had to have so many per mile to make
right.
it possible. And farms are, big farms tend to be out on their own because they own all the land around it.
Well, and that's where we're trying to be very strategic about understanding where those fiber runs are, because they have to drag the fiber someplace.
And they like to put them underground, unlike the old wiring systems that were above. They like them underground because it's a little more stable.
And as we've kind of explored it, they've taught me that there are certain connection points. You just can't drive out and just plug stuff into a cable. There has to be a certain connection point. And how close are those to the farm office and where they need to download the software or upload the information from, you know, the tractors or the combines?
Or so, can they take it from that point and do it wirelessly to the farm that would give them the speed they need? Those types of things.
Exactly. Looking at hybrid systems and those kind of things. So my colleagues are always amazed when we start talking about some of the technology that farms use. And we said, it's just, it's part of business. But they have visions that, you know, it's that 1940s, you know, tractor that we're hand cranking the tractor to get it started. Part of the regional effort was to do some of the initial fiber mapping. We're working right now on trying to understand how to better market that. You know, what kind of industries, whether it's a freelance or a gig-based economy, or whether it's data warehouses or server farms or those kind of things. Is there a market out here for that? So we're kind of working through some of that stuff.
And the advantage of things like a server farm out here is that it's not in a major city where it would be a target.
Right.
I mean, this is out on its own. It's unless you're in the company, you may not even know it's there.
And you know, what started off as 90,000 square feet server farms can be shrunk down into the size of a small retail space in a downtown area. There are certain requirements. They need redundant power so that if the power goes out, you know, because of a thunderstorm or down power line, you got to back up that data because.
And they need to have proper cooling because they tend to run hot.
Hot, right. So, but Michigan is an interesting place because it's a very temperate climate. So we don't get a lot, even though it's been hot during the summer sometimes, but it runs very temperate. So it's not really hot, nor is it really cold. It's not like setting in the desert, trying to run server farms.
And if you're cooling it anyway with air conditioning, you don't have to worry about humidity because
right.
It takes it out anyway.
We've actually looked at some applications where if we could do lake water as a cooling mechanism.
Oh.
And as the water warms, it's good for fishing. So it plays a dual role. Haven't been able to pull that one off yet, but we've kind of looked at it. There's a couple. Google does it in Norway at an old paper mill. So we've done some research on it. Just haven't been able to pull it all together yet.
But these are the types of things EDC looks at. They look to the future. They look ahead to see what's possible, even in a small community.
What we try to do is to look at trends, national, international, global trends, and say how will that impact our local communities? I mean, is it going to impact retail? And how can our local communities take advantage of it? You know, as we look at the implementation of fiber optics, suddenly you can be doing work from one of our small communities and not have to live in Detroit. And we have a quality of life. The kids can be engaged in local schools. You're not lost in a class of 1,000. You have a name and a face. You're just not a number out there someplace. So we have certain characteristics. Is it for everybody? No. But for a certain population, we think that we can offer some really, really nice quality of life issues. So it's just a matter of putting some of the pieces together and marketing them effectively.
And the hard part is staying ahead of the trends because they change so fast.
They change.
10 years ago, you wouldn't have thought you needed all this broadband or gigafiber
right.
stuff. But now everybody's got a computer that's 20,000 times more powerful than the one they had 10 years ago in their pocket.
Exactly. So that's our job, is to watch the trends, understand that. I read a lot of research reports. Sometimes my eyes glaze over and I fall asleep. But the my job is to then start looking at what those trends are. Sometimes it's a challenge for us because we're watching those trends and we're trying to talk to the state about saying, you really need to start focusing on some of our early work with fiber optic and broadband networks. The state wasn't on board with a lot of that stuff. They thought infrastructure was
a big city,
and it didn't impact out here. So we had to kind of push them along periodically. And that's what we're trying to do with some of the stuff that we're doing in downtowns, and how do we re-engage those retail spaces in some of our downtowns. You know, people say, well, you should be doing only retail. Well, we try to tell them retail's changed dramatically. We need to think about and do it strategically. How do we re-engage some of those spaces? We work with building owners, with city managers, with downtown development authorities. But our job is to connect those global trends to our local community. So we're constantly trying to understand what's going on and making sure that we can have a positive impact on our local communities.
And you have to look at how it will affect the community. I mean, we have
right.
small town communities that people are trying to preserve. If they wanted to live in a big city, they'd be in a big city. They like the country atmosphere, the small town feel to it, and they don't want things to grow too big.
Right, and that's always the challenge. It's a very fine line that we walk all the time is, you know, we a lot of people want to see that small town preserved, but if we're not growing, then in certain ways, then we're falling backwards. I mean, we need to constantly monitor, understand what's going on, because it's just like with, you know, if we don't understand that Amazon is going to be a force in retail, then it's going to negatively impact a lot of our retailers. But if we can work with those retailers beforehand so that they understand that Amazon Prime, I can get something in 2 days if I just click on a button.
Almost faster than they can order it from their supplier.
Exactly. So, and, you know, you look at the breadth of what Amazon can carry. How do we, and again, it kind of goes back to, how do we anchor those in place? How do we get something that's different enough that Amazon isn't a competitor or is a small competitor? That's why we're looking at food and beverage as key ingredients, because people have to eat, they want to drink. So,
well, the businesses that thrive around here are the ones that do find a connection to the community. Food and Family Center, I mean, they got big competition from Walmart. People go there because Lowell McDonald and his family just support the community like crazy. I mean, you go there for them.
Absolutely.
Because they're your hometown friends that you want to go see.
Absolutely. And they just happen to sell food on the side.
Well, I mean, but, you know.
Exactly. I mean, they support the community, and that's what we want to make sure that we have those businesses out there that support the community. Absolutely.
And if people have questions on the incubator, and there are space, there'll be strawberries coming in about a month, so if you want to get going, you're going to have to get going.
Get going.
And the schools will be out, so the incubator will be open more hours.
Yep.
They can contact your office.
Absolutely.
To see how they start that process. If they have questions about starting a business of any kind, whether it's retail or whatever, they can help you. You can help them get business plan information and such, that they look like they know what they're doing when they go to the bank.
Absolutely.
And you can help them in many other ways. If a community needs something, you can look for grants for them, things like that that
absolutely
they may not even know are out there. Even though times were tough the last few, almost a decade now, there are still grants out there, things that are earmarked certain dollars for certain things that you can
absolutely. And our job is to kind of knit those resources together. We've discovered that this, as the state's programs have changed, the federal government has some really interesting ones with an organization that impacts the area, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So they have many, many programs that we feel comfortable with and we understand, and we can get some of the resources out to the local communities.
Your phone number?
989-269-6431.
Thanks for being with us here today.
Thanks for having me.
We're kind of running out of time.
Okay.
Our guest has been Carl Asantosky, Executive Director of the Huron County Economic Development Corporation. I do want you to stay tuned. Coming up at the top of the hour, we'll clue you in on the latest in the news.